Okay. What we're going to talk tonight is first of all, welcome to everyone. And again, thank you, Rabbi Kalman, for this incredibly exciting technology. It's a wonderful opportunity. And especially tonight, we're going to talk about a great topic. Welcome, Judah. Welcome, Rabbi Yisrael. It's really great to see you all. What we're going to be discussing is a hugely important topic. The question about, is one ever allowed to disobey orders in the Israeli army? And one thing I want to make clear at the outset is that we're going to be assuming that the Israeli government, the Israeli army, which is carries out the orders of the Israeli government, is considered to be, to a certain extent, as a melech. It has the authority, the political authority, to act on behalf of the residents of Medinat Yisrael, of the State of Israel, something that Rav Kook and Rav Waldenberg both assume in their teshuvot. Now, based on that, we'll move forward by telling the following two scenarios. One that happened in 1982, and another in 2005. In 1982, we had the following situation. A friend of mine was an American who was learning in Yeshivat Har Etzion and was inspired by the yeshiva's ideals and decided not only to learn in the yeshiva on a full-time basis, but also that he wanted to serve in the army as well for 9 months. And he served in a difficult time in the Lebanon War. So he was in Lebanon and in a tank corps. And the tanks had to be restarted every single day because he wanted to make sure that, especially in the winter, he wanted to make sure that the engine didn't freeze. So every day they had to start it up. That was the protocol. And this young man realized that we have a problem, because if they're going to have to start every day, what's going to be for Shabbos? So he spoke to the base commander in advance. What they're going to have to do is to make sure to start the tank right before Shabbos and right after Shabbos, and this way the problem will be solved. The commander said, no, they're not going to do that, but they're going to insist that the tank be restarted as it had been done every single day of the week at 2 o'clock on Shabbos as well. And this young man said, well, that's not acceptable. The Israeli law protects the right of every soldier to observe Shabbat, and this is a non-essential need and didn't need to be done. And this young soldier did all his due diligence. He checked with his Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Yehuda Mital, Rav Yeshivat Har Etzion, who himself served the colonel and the officer in the Israeli army since the 1948 war. And Rav Mital told him there was no reason why the tank had to be started on Shabbat. It was investigated elsewhere as well. There was no need to start it. But yet, this officer hangs firm that it was impossible. It had to be, that tank had to be started on Shabbat. So what's going to be done? So what this young man did was he started his tank right before Shabbat started, and it just to make sure that it should be, God forbid, in case that it needed to go into battle, that there shouldn't be any problems. So we started right before Shabbat. Came on Shabbos itself. At about 2 o'clock, the order came from the officer, turn on that tank and turn on now. And the young man asked the officer, is this an issue of pikuach nefesh? Is there any danger of life? And the officer said, no, this is not an issue of pikuach nefesh, but I want you to follow my order. And he said again, the young man asked, is there any pikuach nefesh? Is there any danger to life? And again, it was clarified, there was no danger to life, just saying, you must follow my order, and that was it. Clearly, it seemed that this officer was just trying to force the soldier to be mechalel Shabbat, to desecrate the Shabbat. And at that point, the officer, the young man, had refused, and He was supposedly was going to be given some trouble and a consequence to be put into the army jail. This was the threat. After Shabbos was over, the young man appealed to various authorities, and he was not put. He was not given into trouble. In fact, the officer could have been put into trouble since he had violated Israeli law. But this young man had violated an order given to him by his officer in Sahal. That was 1982. Now let's fast forward 23 years ahead to the terrible summer of 1985. Who had graduated our yeshiva, my yeshiva high school where I teach here in Teaneck, Torah Academy, Bergen County. And this young man, at this point, was now serving in the Israeli army. And he was going to be one of the young men who were going to be taking part in the pinui, in the evacuation of the Jewish communities of Gaza. And various rabbis were giving him various advice. So he saw that some rabbis said that he should be mefer b'kuda, such as the Rav Harashi, the former Rav Harashi, the Rosh Yeshiva of Merkaz HaRav, of Avram Shapira, said that officers, all the Israeli soldiers must be mefer b'kuda. They must refuse to obey orders in this circumstance. And then, on the other hand, we had Rav Aaron Lichtenstein and Rav Avad Yosef and other Rabbanim as well, who said that no, that one should not disobey orders in such a circumstance, that even though we're not happy with the orders, one should not disobey the orders. So my student called me to know what to do, which rabbi to follow. So he called his old high school Rebbe. What should he do? Should he obey the orders or should he disobey the orders? So I won't tell you what I tell them, but I'll give the shiur, and at the end of the shiur, I'll discuss what the final decision that came about in this difficult situation. Let's begin with some very, very basic fundamentals, going back all the way to Parshat Shoftim. In Parshat Shoftim, Moshe Rabbeinu introduces a dramatic change, and that is a division of power. That there's going to be a melech, a king, shoftim, judges, kohanim and levim to teach Torah, and a navi who is going to be transmitting the word of Hashem to the nation, telling the nation and its leaders if they're doing right or if they're doing wrong. Now this is a dramatic revolution, because previously Moshe Rabbeinu occupied all the positions of power. He was the teacher of Torah, of course. He was the melech. He was the political leader. He was a judge. He was the chief judge. He was certainly the Navi communicating from a Kadosh Baruch Hu. And Moshe Rabbeinu now, as he's about to die, preparing Am Yisrael for his death and their entry into Eretz Yisrael after he dies, tells them, you're going to be dividing Am Yisrael, the leadership of our people, into four different groups. Now, why did Moshe Rabbeinu change? Why was there a need to change? So it seems as follows, that although there is certainly an advantage to have one person occupying all positions of authority, nevertheless, there is a disadvantage in that one person can, as they say, one person can go wrong, because as John Locke, the famous British philosopher, once said, absolute power corrupts absolutely. So Moshe Rabbeinu is now going about a change. That he introduces a change that you're not going to have one person occupying all positions, but rather there's going to be a balance of power. This way, if one person goes astray, the other can correct them. If the melech, the political leader, is going to make a mistake, then the navi will tell him he does something wrong. If the shoftim are doing something wrong, the melech can correct them. if the Kohanim and the Levim are not teaching Torah properly, the Shoftim correct them. A balance of power by having four different groups watch of that they don't go astray. So why wasn't this done in Moshe Rabbeinu's time? Because Moshe Rabbeinu was so great. He was such an outstanding leader that he was able to occupy all four positions. But Moshe Rabbeinu is unique. It's hard to replicate the situation of Moshe Rabbeinu in situations beyond merely, beyond that great leader. What to do when you do not have someone like Moshe Rabbeinu? So when you do not have a great leader like Moshe Rabbeinu, then you need to share power. But you have a disadvantage. The disadvantage, and this is the key point, you have Shnei Melachim Mishtamshim B'Keser Achad. You have two kings that are using one crown, meaning you have shared power, and it's not clear who is the person in charge. What's going to happen if you have an unresolved conflict between the Melach and the Shoftim? If the Melech, the political leader, says one thing, and then the religious leadership, the Kohanim and the Levim, or the Shoftim, say another, who do you follow? Not very clear. Let's try to look at some sources, including the ones, especially the ones that you have available in the PDF file. Which who comes first? So let's begin first in source number one in the file. You find the Rambam writes in Hilchos Melachim in Perek Beis Halacha Hey that the Rambam is supposed to have a read the whole thing. It's right, Hamelach Mistaper B'chol Yom. The king gets a haircut every single day, so let's have great dignity. Umisaken Otsmo Misnab Mabushim Noam Forim, and he wears very dignified clothes. The Yoshev al Kisei Malchuso, and he sits on his throne, and he puts his crown on, and anyone, whenever he summons somebody, they must come to him whenever he summons them, and whenever one appears in front of the king, you bow down to the king. Now we get to the conflict. Now we have to start figuring out from the Rambam who takes precedence over whom. He says Afilu Navi. Omei l'fnei melech, even if the Navi comes in front of the melech, mishtachav ve'artza. The Navi must express, the prophet must express kavod, this honor to the king. He bows down, as we find with Nathan HaNavi in the beginning of Sefer Melachim. The great Nathan HaNavi bows down before he speaks to David HaMelech. Aval kode, Baba, now let's see about the Kohen Gadol. Kohen Gadol ein obal l'fnei HaMelech elim ratza. The Kohen Gadol only appears before the king if he wants. So the king, the Melech, cannot summon the high priest, the Kohen Gadol. V'ena omid l'fan of Ela HaMelech omlis ne'er Kohen Gadol. The Kohen Gadol doesn't go to the Melech goes to the Kohen Gadol. Wow. But nevertheless, Abba Bikain, HaMitzvah, Kohen Gadol, HaChabetz HaMelech, the Kohen Gadol nevertheless must give the Melech, the king, this great honor. He must stand before him. Now, when does the king come before the Kohen Gadol? Only when he needs to consult the Urim the Tumim. Okay, so we have sometimes the king comes before the Kohen Gadol, sometimes the Kohen Gadol comes before the king. One time the king has precedence over the Kohen Gadol, other times the Kohen Gadol has precedence over the king. Now, let's go with the conflict between Torah scholars and the king. There's a conflict. The Rambam says as follows. There's a mitzvah on the Melech to honor those who study Torah. When the Sanhedrin enters in front of the king, Yamod Usnam, you should stand in front of them. V'chenei Yoshafat, the great, the righteous king Yoshafat, when a Talmud Chacham would appear to him, even if it wasn't a great, it wasn't the head of the Sanhedrin, and he would stand in front of him, he would give him, the Yehoshaphat, the king, would give honor to the scholar, and he would kiss him, and call him Rebbe, stand before him. When did the king do this? Only when the private, when the Melech Beveso. Huva Vadav. Although the Sarhesya, but in public, very different. This Ne'am lo yase, he cannot do that. He cannot compromise the prestige of the king. Lo yamod osnif ne'adam, he cannot stand in front of anybody. Lo yidaber rakos, he cannot speak softly. Ella he must impose his fear and his awe and respect for him in front of everybody. There must be this awe and respect, otherwise the country cannot function. Okay, so what is it seen from the Rambam? Who seems to have the priority in terms of the Torah scholars? Or is it the king? Who seems to have first? Because I have some answers. Let's see if you want to type it in. Any thoughts? Or I'll go it alone. Judah's typing in something. The king. Okay? That's what it seems. Well, on the other hand, it does say that sometimes the king has to give more cover to the Talmud Chacham. Maybe privately, but it's... Any thoughts? Okay. Okay, so now, what about, so, all right, it seems that it's not clear who has priority, because sometimes the melech comes first, sometimes okay, historically or now. Well, let's talk. Today the Kohen and the Torah scholar are the same. Okay, let's lump them together. Let's lump the Kohen and the Torah and the Talmud Chacham together. Let's assume that, but it would seem that sometimes under certain circumstances, the Kohen comes first, and under other circumstances, the melech comes first, and same thing with the Talmud Chacham. There's a distinction in private and public, but nevertheless in private it seems the Talmud Chacham has priority, but other times the melech has priority. So it doesn't seem that there's absolute clear guidance. Let's go to source number two for a clearer case of when there's a conflict of between the melech, between the leader, political leader, and the spiritual leader. Speaks about the following situation, source number two. The story of Yiftach and his daughter. And we all know this tragic story of Yiftach, a political leader in Sefer Shoftim, who, before going to battle with Ammon, made a promise, a neder to Hashem, that if he's victorious and he comes home, the first thing that comes out of his house, he will offer as a korban. Not a good decision on Yiftach's part, because when he came home victorious, the first thing that came out of his house was his daughter. Now he's got a problem. He's got to sacrifice his daughter. What is he going to do? He's caught in a bind. So his daughter, ultimately there was no resolution, and his daughter either was sacrificed or was not able to, had to remain celibate for the rest of her life, and could not marry. So here's our big problem. Yiftach had a solution. Why did Yiftach have to honor his neder? How could he have been released? What would have been the solution to this problem? He just could have had what? If I can ask, if you can type it in. All he needed was Hataras Nedarim. Right? Like we do. He just could have gone to a Beis Din, and the Beis Din could have engaged in the process that we all engage in Erev Rosh Hashanah, saying that, had I known, the basis would have asked, had you known that it was your daughter that would be coming out of the door, would be the first thing coming out of the door, would you have made that promise in the first place? Promising that the first thing coming out of your house would have been offered as a korban? Yiftach would have answered no. The basin would have released him from this neder, and his daughter would be able to live a normal life. So why didn't Yiftach go to a Beis Din for Hataras Nedarim? It's a huge question. So let's see how the Medrash solved this problem. And the Medrash cites this in source number two in the handout in the file. Tosfos in Tanis Daled Amud Aleph says as follows: tells the following story, that the Gadol Hador in that time was Pinchas. He's a spiritual leader. And they had a problem. And that there was a standoff. Pinchas, Yiftach said, that let Pinchas come to me. That if for Atar Sadarim, Pinchas will come to me and he'll release my neder. And Pinchas says, the Melech needs me, let the Melech come to me. And there was a standoff. And the reason why Yiftach was not released from his neder was because both leaders would not budge. The spiritual leader would not budge, Pinchas wouldn't budge. And Pinchas said that I'm going to remain in where I am. I'm not going to go to Yiftach. Yiftach said, I'm not going to Pinchas. And who suffered as a result? Yiftach's poor daughter was the one that wound up suffering. And indeed, in the end, Tosu says that both of them were punished. Both Pinchas was punished. He was relieved of his being the Gadol Hador, the spiritual leader. And Yiftach was punished that he lost limbs before his death. Tragic situation on all ends. So where does that leave us with? Does this leave us with clarity about what we should do when there's a conflict between the political and spiritual leadership? It seems not so clear. And in fact, can anyone suggest to me in Jewish history, besides the Melech, where have we had, let's start in the time of the Gemara, when did we have conflicts between political and spiritual leadership? Any thoughts when we've had that? We've had that in the time of in the Gemara. Saul and okay, that's right. Well, they're clearly, that's a good example. This week's Haftorah, actually, Rabbi Akiva and Bar Kochva. That's okay. Let's first think about Saul and Shmuel. Right, that's correct. That is a good example. Shmuel said, Saul, you got to hang up your cleats. You're right, that you're not king anymore. And Saul refused to do that. Rabbi Akiva and Bar Kochva at a certain point. That's an excellent example. I was thinking a lot of times you have, in the Gemara, you find a conflict between the Reish Galusa, the political leader of Jewry in Babylonia, and on the other hand, the Chachamim and the sages. You had different approaches about who should be the leader. I'm sorry, whose rule should be followed? And where do we have this today, outside of Israel? Where do we have that in communities throughout the world and probably throughout the centuries? You had conflicts between political and spiritual leaders. In shuls, you have this. Right? You have sometimes, what if you have a conflict? Not in any shuls that we're familiar with, but sure there we have conflicts between the president and the rabbi. It's not so clear halachically sometimes which way do you follow. The political leader is supposed to be a little bit more pragmatic, and the Torah leader has to be one who is teaching values. So a lot of times we have this conflict, and it's difficult to know how to resolve these issues. Let's take a look in source number 5 in the handout, where we can try to get a little bit more of a sense of what the halakha would say. Now, the Rambam says as follows, Halakha Ches, this is in Hilchos Malachim Perek Yimel, Kol Hamori B'melech Yisrael, anyone who rebels against the king, Yeshul Melech Rishus Lahar, go. The king can kill them. Wow. However, the Rambam says, Hamavata Gzeras HaMelech V'Sushin Is Asik B'Mitzvos. If one ignores the king, he violates an order of the king because he's involved in the mitzvah, Afilu HaMitzvah Kala, even if it's a relatively, what would appear to be a relatively unimportant mitzvah or relatively minor mitzvah, Arei Zeh Patur, then the king cannot kill that person. Why? Divrei Harav, Divrei Eved, Divrei Harav Kodmin. There's a conflict between the master and the servant, the master comes first. So there's a conflict between a mitzvah and a king. The king's order, the mitzvah comes first. So if the king says, eat this piece of chazer, you must eat this, you must have this ham sandwich, one is not obligated to listen to the king. Vein tzarach lomar, most certainly, im gaza hamel v'vata mitzvah, she'ein shomim lo, that we do not listen to him in such a circumstance. Okay? So says the Rambam. And let's give some examples in Tanakh. Can anyone think in Tanakh of a of a case conflict between David and who? David and Natan? Well, that's where the Navi gave Musar to David. But there was something related to David. Uriah. Okay. In that case, it's interesting. Uriah refused to listen to an order of David. But David just told him to go home to his wife, which would appear to be non-conflict with the Torah. That actually is interesting. That is a good example of Natan, of Uriah, actually. I'm going to give a different example. I'm going to give the story of Shaul and Kohanei Nov and the leaders of Nov. What happened in this case was that David HaMelech was running away from Shaul. The Kohanim of Nov had no idea that David was running away from Shaul. David did not disclose that this is what he was doing. And he told the people of Nov that he needed food. The Kohanim in Nov gave him food. Shaul found this out, and Shaul wanted to kill all of the Kohanim at Nov. Shaul gave the order to his general, to Avner, to kill everyone, and to kill all the to kill all of the Kohanim. And did Avner follow the order? Records the Navi, Avner refused the order. Now, what do you think Chazal say about him? Did Chazal praise Avner, or did they criticize Avner? They praised him. So says the Gemara in Testament Aleph. And getting back to Uriah, when David HaMelech gave the order to Yoav to take Uriah Hachiti and put Uriah Hachiti on the front lines and then abandon him, allowed him, and Yoav actually fulfilled this order. He didn't disobey the order, even though he was killing somebody. Chazal criticized him. Chazal saying again, same Gemara in Sanhedrin Mem Testament Aleph, that Yoav was wrong. He should have disobeyed orders. So sometimes one's supposed to disobey orders. On the other hand, we have to sometimes judge from what is not written in the Gemara. And the Gemara in Daf Mem Tes offers no criticism for Yoav for following David's command to count the nation. Even though Yoav said to David HaMelech, he doesn't think it's such a good idea, but they do not criticize him. Even though David was seemingly violating an order of the Torah, a mitzvah of the Torah, Yoav followed it. Nevertheless, there's no criticism for Yoav. Wow. So sometimes it seems one is supposed to disobey an order. Avner disobeyed an order and he was praised by Chazal. Yoav did not disobey an order and he was criticized for not disobeying the order. On the other hand, Yoav obeyed an order that was in violation, seemingly in violation of the Torah, and he was not punished. So, what does it seem? Any thoughts? Any thoughts so far about? What do we say about the story? The 1982 story. We get an order from the officer. Someone's life is at stake. Seems to be the difference. Okay. That's a good one. Okay. That may be very right. That sometimes if somebody's life is at stake, there would be no excuse to violate the Torah. There's no excuse. Right. You disobey the Melech, as opposed to count the nation, then you would listen. That very well may be. I haven't seen that answer given, but that very well may be. Let's take a look at some sources. But if it's not in order to kill someone, then maybe you have to listen to the king's orders. Interesting thought. Let's go to source number three. Let's go to a righteous melech, the king Chizkiyahu. This is from Gemara in Pesachim on Nun Hey Amid Beis. The Gemara says as follows: Tana Rabbanan Shisha Dvarim Asa Chizkiyahu HaMelech, that there were six things that the king Chizkiyah did. And remember, he's a righteous king. He's the only king in Sefer Melachim who's compared and considered as great as David HaMelech. Definitely an incredibly righteous melech. And the Gemara records that three things Chazal gave him yashakach. They thought that he did correctly, three radical religious points, and three lo hodulo. Three things they didn't give him a yashakach. They didn't congratulate him. But as we're going to stress, they didn't criticize him. They didn't congratulate him, but they kept silent. What do they give him yashakach? What do they congratulate him? They congratulate him when he was girer atzamos aviv, when he took his father's father's bones, and after that, and he's girer mita shel chavalin, and he dragged those bones on a bed of ropes, and to basically take his father, who was an evil Russia's father Menashe, and he publicly denigrated Menashe, trying to say that I'm going to be running this country very differently than my father. Behodul and Chazal gave him a yashakar for that radical stance. And then Kites Nechash Nechoshet, the copper serpent that Moshe Rabbeinu made, that's recorded in Parshas Chukas, came Chizkiyahu, and he ground it up because the people were using it as a varazara, the hodulo, and they gave him yashakach. Ginei Sefer Refuos, he took medical books and he put them and he was gonez them. He put them away. He hid them so people would not have access to doctors, so that instead they would have to daven to Hashem. And remarkably, hodulo, and they gave him a yashakach. Unbelievable. Sasam ne gichon hel yon lo hodulo. Here's where they did not congratulate him. When he was attacked by the king of Ashur, he closed the waters of the Gichon in order that the invading army should not have access to water. And Chazal say, no, we should not have disrupted the environment of Yerushalayim. Even though he's being invaded by this huge superpower at the time of Ashur, who was fierce and seemed to have no chance to defeat them, and he did not want to fight them, and he cut off their water supply. Chazal said, no, he shouldn't have disrupted Yerushalayim's environment, and should have more trust in Hashem. Chazal didn't criticize him, but they didn't give him congratulations. Now here's the key case. Kitzei Dalzah Shel Heichal, Shigrin LeMelech Asher, he tried to bribe the king of Asher by giving him wealth, and he didn't have any resources. So what did he do? He removed the doors to the Heichal and the Beis HaMikdash. What a step that he took. And he sent to the king of Asher. So basically, Chizkiyahu HaMelech desecrated the Beis HaMikdash in order to try to attain peace, to appease the king of Asher. And Chazal didn't criticize him, but they didn't give him yashakach. And then he added an extra month to the year, in the month of Nisan, which we're not going to discuss right now. But I want to discuss the case of that he desecrated the Beis HaMikdash, and Chazal didn't criticize him, but they didn't congratulate him. But here's the question. Obviously, Chazal were not happy with this. So here's the question. If they weren't happy with his removing of the doors of the Beis HaMikdash, why did Chazal not criticize him? Any thoughts? Why did they criticize him? Okay. Says the Tiferes Yisrael, because of Amos HaMalchus. Because out of respect to the king. Out of respect to the king, they didn't congratulate him, but they would not give him a yashar koach for what he did. And this may give us the following thought. It seems to me that the reason why that the rabbis held back their criticism of Chizkiyahu was because they felt that it was an ambiguous situation. What is meant, Eimat HaMelech, in order to preserve the dignity and the authority of the king. Okay? So it would appear to me that you're dealing with an ambiguous situation, that it was not clear whether it was right or wrong for Chizkiyahu to cut down the doors of the Heichal and send it as an attempt to appease the king of Ashur, Sennacherib. And because it was ambiguous, Chazal kept quiet. They were neutral. They abstained from approval or disapproval. Now we're going to get more on point to a following situation. What if Talmidei Chachamim, let's say they were in the army, in Chizkiyahu's army, and they were given the order to cut down the doors of the Heichal? Should they have disobeyed that order, or should they have obeyed that order? Not clear. What should they have done in that situation? So it would seem that it would seem in that situation that since an ambiguous. That Tamidi Yeshiva, they must follow orders. If the Chachamim did not register their disapproval because of Amos HaMalchus, because out of respect to the nation, to the leadership of the king, it would seem that in case of ambiguity, that it would be the right thing for the Talmidei HaYeshiva would have to follow the orders. And that one could be, is there an explicit halacha not to take down doors? I believe so. There's an explicit halacha that we're not supposed to destroy the Beit HaMikdash. And Chizkiyahu was violating it, arguing that it was a case of pikuach nefesh, that it was a case of danger to life, and it was a life of the nation. Is that destroying, take them down and put up? One could argue maybe that's not destroying. I hear. Certainly one could say that it's a chil Hashem, that for one to take down the doors of the Mace of English and send it to an evil pagan king, Sennacherib of Ashur, and so certainly would be wrong to do under normal circumstances, but if it's, but the argument was, it's a case of Pikuach Nefesh, and a case of Pikuach Nefesh that you would have to try to help, to try to, maybe you can it would be justified, this chil Hashem, because you're trying to save the people, save lives. So that's why it seems to be the ambiguity. Chazal felt that Chizkiyahu should have had more faith. He should have just shouldn't have taken this drastic action. Whereas Chizkiyahu felt as a king that he has to be more pragmatic. So it's in a situation of ambiguity. I would give a now let's go to so my argument is that in case of ambiguity, that one should follow, that one must obey the order of the king. Let's try to go to, is there a significance, lo micho and lo hodu? That's an interesting point. Okay. Yes. The significance of the Mishnah is that, that the Mishnah speaks about the people of Yericho acting in a certain way, and that micho b'yadim and chazal registered their approval. I'm sorry, registered their disapproval. And but by Chizkiyahu they didn't register their disapproval, because to individuals they don't hesitate to express the criticism. However, to a melech they felt that sometimes it was smarter to lo hodu, which would be not to register their criticism. Now, if there's a difference between lo micho and lo hodu, actually, I'm thinking, Jude, I think you're hitting on a gold mine, because I think that's a huge point. That when lo hodu, as opposed to giving they don't congratulate. So the lo micho, so they didn't, were moche, they didn't, moche perhaps means prevent. Now, by saying lo micho implies they have the ability to be moche. That the chacham have the ability, or the Torah right to be moche, to prevent the melech to act in a certain way. That's not clear at all. Was that question sent properly? I didn't see it. Okay. Judah was asking, is there a difference between that the Mishnah says that the people of Yericho lo micho, they didn't object, as opposed to the people of... there we go. That's Judah just should put it on for all. That's a huge question. That's really a huge question. And it might be, by the fact that it doesn't say lo michu by a melech, perhaps because they didn't have the ability to be mocha. Mocha might be understood as being preventing. Okay. Someone wanted to talk? Rabbi Jay?
Oh, it's just, it's the present there. It's okay. Go ahead.
Okay, now, here's my thought. Let's go to, before we go to 1982 and 2005, let's go back to 1953. 1953, the West German government is offering Israel State of Israel reparations, and billions of dollars in reparations for the Holocaust. And does anybody know what Ben-Gurion, did he want to take it or not want to take it? Ben-Gurion said, take it. On the other hand, at that, right, right. The BG, yes, that's correct. Ben-Gurion said yes, and the Rav was absolutely positively against that. Eshel Hava against that. And so the question would be, well, as was Begin. Begin was big time against it. But Begin was not the Rav, even though his father was Reb Chaim Soloveitchik Gabay, an interesting historical footnote. So the question is, let's say if you were working in the Israeli government at that point, and you were given the order to work on getting those reparations from West Germany. So what did you do if you were that government worker? Do you follow BG, do you follow Ben-Gurion, or do you follow the Rav? You follow Rav Soloveitchik, who was Eish Lahava, who was absolutely, positively, strongly opposed, vociferously opposed to receiving those reparations. So it would seem to me that this is the case of it's ambiguous. Because here's a clear example of when the melech is doing what he has to do and a chacham doing what they have to do. The melech was doing what he had to do, and that is to be pragmatic and look out for the best interests of his people. The chacham, on the other hand, have to promote values. And Torah values are that one should not accept anything from a melech or a melech-like people. So it seems that the Rav was right and Ben-Gurion was right. Ben-Gurion had to do what he had to do, and the Rav had to register protest. And the king, again, it would seem to me that if you were working with the government at that time, you had to listen to Ben-Gurion's order and to deal with the reparations from West Germany. I should, by the way, add, just as an aside, that Rav Soloveitchik said to me many years later, in 1983, I was driving him to the airport, and we were discussing the question of buying a German car, and Rav Soloveitchik said to me, you know, I think I was wrong when I told Ben-Gurion. I think I may have been wrong. That's a really remarkable statement that he said to me. I can still hear the Rav saying that. It was quite remarkable. Meaning that, because he said, how else could have Israel have developed as well as it did if it wasn't for if it wasn't accepting for those reparations. Question for Rav Yisrael. Go ahead, shoot.
I understand there's a comparison between a secular Jew and a Melech Yisrael, but I'm wondering if there's a difference in that, because the Melech Yisrael is appointed by a Navi, let's say, and he's holy observant himself, that perhaps you should listen to a secular Jewish president slash king.
I don't see your question.
Matters, but when you're getting it to halachic maybe not so.
Could you repeat your question? I'm sorry, I didn't hear or type it out. I'm sorry.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, I can hear you.
So I understand you're making a comparison between a Jewish, an Israeli president, that he's something of a Jewish king, and that in ambiguous cases, cases where he conflicts with a religious leader, or ambiguous cases, you should listen to him. But I'm wondering about that, because an Israeli president, if he's not halakhically observant and he's not appointed by a Navi, that perhaps you should be listening to him on secular matters, even if they infringe perhaps on democratic freedom, but maybe not so on halakhic matters. So it's not a perfectly analogous case to a true melech. It has some similarities, but it's not completely equivalent.
Okay, that's a good question. Now the question is, what kind of halachic matters do you say that the melech can intrude? If the melech says, let's say the melech gave an order, or the Israeli prime minister says that you have to put up a sign saying that this store is kosher. Now, understand, in the state of Israel, Kashrus is under the Israeli government. You don't have separation of church and state. So let's say the melech says, you put up that sign that says that this store is kosher. Or, I hate to say it, I think there was a case, I'll put it on tape, privately I can discuss it. But let's say theoretically the prime minister said that, gave the orders to the rabbis, the store must be labeled kosher even though it's not. That place clearly that then you would disobey the order of the prime minister, and I would say in the case of 1982 case, there it's black and white. The king is telling you to do something wrong, and therefore you don't follow it in the military situation. Or even if, let's say, a store is ambiguous if it's kosher or not, the king says, the prime minister says, put up a sign that says it's kosher. In that case, I agree with you. You're not going to follow what the king has to say. But what if you have a matter which is, you know, it's not clear, is it strictly halacha or is it policy, such as a question of reparations from, taking reparations from Germany? Well, it's not a ritual matter, it's a public policy issue. And it's a public policy question, and it's a question, is this public policy in violation of Torah values? Or is it something that, is it clearly in conflict with Torah values? Or is it, is it ambiguous if it violates Torah policies? I would say in that kind of a situation, there, if it's not absolutely clear that the king is telling you to do something wrong, that, or the prime minister is telling you something wrong, that you should listen to the prime minister in that kind of a situation. So, any thoughts?
Well, I'm thinking this. If the U.S. president told me to go work for the CIA rather than be a college professor, I could say to him, no, I'm sorry, I'm going to be a college professor. But it could be if the Israeli president told me to go work for the Mossad instead of college, then I should listen to him. But then if he told me to do anything that violated even a love or a mitzvah, I say, even a derabanan, that I shouldn't listen, I should not listen to him, even if it's ambiguous. That would be the difference. So something that's very inconvenient, that impinges upon my freedom, I would not have to listen to the U.S. president, but I would have to listen to the Israeli. But as soon as it gets any way in the area of law, I wouldn't have to listen to him.
Well, then I'll just to help you, the question is, what's defined as halacha? Just to help you understand this question, they tell a story about, I think it's Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, that before he got married, he and his wife made a deal. He would take care of spiritual matters, and she would decide all practical matters. Then they figured this way they would never have to get into an argument. And for the next 50 years, they argued over what's spiritual, what's material, what's gashmis, what's ruchnias. So here also, it's not so clear what exactly is gashmis, what's ruchnias, you know, what's spiritual, what's halacha, what's not halacha. So it's not, to my mind, this question of accepting reparations from Germany, it's not clear if this is a halachic issue or more of a policy issue. So that's an interesting question. Now let's go to the 1982 case. 1982, if you get the order to... You get the order the young man got that order, turn on that tank on Shabbos. The young man did his absolute due diligence. It was absolutely 100% clear. It was not a case of pikuach nefesh. It was not undermining army security. It was just an officer who was violating his Israeli law and ordering him to be Mechal Shabbos. In that case, this case unambiguous. That seems to be a case that the Rambam is describing. If the Melech says to violate a mitzvah, in that case you don't have to listen to the law. So it seemed in that case that young man was absolutely correct in what he did. And by the way, that young man was later to be a very chashuv Rebbe in one of the yeshivot has there. And so it seemed he did the 100% correct thing. Now, what about, now let's go to the harder question. Let's move up to 2005. My Talmud, he's in the Israeli army. He gets the order, participate in the evacuation of Jewish communities in Gaza. Okay? So that's what gets to Yisrael's question. Is this a halachic issue? Is it a policy issue? Well, there is a halachic issue because you're giving over land of in Eretz Yisrael to non-Jews, and that's a violation of the Yisrael of Lo Tichanein, which Chazal understand to be Lo Titein Lem Chanei Abakarka, that we're not allowed to give land, Israeli land, over to non-Jews. But on the other hand, it's Pikoch Nefesh. It's a case of danger to life. And so do we say that danger to life overrides the prohibition of Lo Tichanein? Well, that's not so clear. Some Rabbanim say yes, some say no. Rabbi Avad Yosef says yes. Rav Lumstein says yes. Other Rabbanim say that no, we have to hold on to Eretz Yisrael, even at the cost of lives. Okay. Now, Gaza may not be Israel, specs fake. Okay, good one. Can you hear me now? Okay. Gaza is okay. Now, that's a good question, right? The borders of Eretz Yisrael given in Parshas Noach are Bocha Gra Araza. So Gaza seems to be the border. But Rav Rosenberg has a tshuva where he says Gaza is definitely part of Eretz Yisrael. May not be part of the borders conquered by the Jews that conquered Eretz Yisrael in the time of Yoshua. That's an interesting spekfeka. And Rabbi Kelman is 100% correct. It's questions which way the Pikoch Nefesh. Which is it better off? Is it better off to evacuate? Not better to evacuate. But who has to make that decision? L'chora, the Prime Minister is the one that has to make this decision, even if we're not very pleased with the way he is making that decision. So it would seem, now offhand, it would seem to me that it would be an unambiguous that it's ambiguous. It's ambiguous whether... Let me finish the point, and I'll take Rabbi Kalman your question. It would seem to me an ambiguous situation whether it was permitted, according to the halacha, to evacuate Gaza. If, again, if you're assuming that it's Pikoch Nefesh, and assuming that the Prime Minister is the one to make that decision. So it seems to me that you have one possibility. You have the some rabbanim say that it's mutter. Some rabbanim would say it's usher to give up land, if it would hopefully reduce it would save Jewish lives. So you have different opinions. So it's ambiguous, offhand it would seem that I should have told my student that he should not disobey orders. It seems to be an ambiguous situation. Rabbi Kalman, go ahead.
I was going to say there are really two, in my mind, two distinct issues. One is you listen to your Rosh Hashiva or whatever, or the military orders. That's one issue. Just irrespective, if you assume that the state of Israel is the scene of a melech, so they perhaps override any strike of a Rosh Hashiva or whatever. That's the issue. But then there's the second issue on the merits of the case itself. In other words, if you take a look, you're assuming the Israeli government is doing what they think is best for Pikoch Nefesh, but that's not always true. Sometimes the government admits, like when Rabin made his famous comments, sacrifices for peace or whatever. Sometimes the government admits it's not going to save lives, but for international politics or together with the Europeans, for whatever calculations they may have. And I guess my question is, does that at all play into the decision? In other words, if they're using criteria which are different, separate from the issue, can you ever disobey their orders?
I think that the governments, when they're for international politics, they're not doing it. Hopefully, they're not doing it in order to win the Nobel Prize, but hopefully, they're doing it in what's in the best interest of the United Israel. And if they're going to be better international ties, then they'll be more, then Israel will be in a better position diplomatically, politically, which will be better off and will improve the security. Because Arabs are less likely to want to attack us if we have positive connections with the Europeans and with the Americans. So, being a leader of Midian and Israel is not an easy job. You've got to balance. Sometimes you have to make decisions. You have to choose the least worst of all the options. So I agree with you. I know where you're heading. The withdrawal from Gaza may not have been to save lives, but may have been on the diplomatic front, what somebody's trying to accomplish. That is actually an important point that you're raising. But I think that's part of the prerogative of the king. The king has to, ultimately, a melech or even the prime minister has to act in the best interest of the people. Now, I just want to raise one point, two more points, and we'll call it a night. I know we're a little late. But two more important points, and that is as follows. In my mind, it was unambiguously wrong to evacuate the Jewish community from Gaza, and not the issue because of Lo Sechanim, but I thought what was to my mind was just awful was the fact that these Jews were evacuated and they were given no place to go, no plans it was still more than a year and a half later. And still a majority of the people evacuated still had no jobs. So to my mind, this was an unexcusable act of the Israeli government, the wrong way to treat its citizens, especially its most loyal and devoted citizens. So I found that it profoundly disturbing. So to my mind, it was unambiguously wrong. So what did I tell my Talmud to do? Did I tell him to? But based on the shir so far, l'chora, I should have said to my Talmud that you should disobey orders. The government's telling you to do something which is clearly wrong. But nevertheless, I told him to obey orders because as follows. What's that? I don't know how I would treat my Talmud. Oh, I didn't know that at that point. I think you're right, but I think Yisrael is raising an important issue. But I think, however, that the Israeli, it was clear at that point, we knew in August 2005 that the government didn't have a plan. Okay, that I think was pretty clear. Now, on the other hand, even though I thought the government was unambiguously wrong, I told my Talmud not to disobey orders because of the following reasons. Source number four, from the Sefer HaChinuch. The Sefer HaChinuch makes an incredibly important point. And this is where, really, I think Rav Avad Yosef and Rav Lichtenstein and Rav Shlomo Aviner, three major Rabbanim who said not to disobey orders, this is where I think they were coming from. They said as follows. I think this is where they were coming from. The Sefer HaChinuch writes, in Mitzvah Ayin Aleph, there's a Mitzvah Shlo L'Kal HaNasi, that we're not supposed to curse, not supposed to denigrate a leader. And the Sefer HaChinuch writes, it points to an important point, that every community needs a leader. You can't function without a leader. Sometimes leaders will be good, sometimes leaders will be poor. But he says an incredible point. He says that it's better to have, you cannot curse even a poor leader. You cannot denigrate even a poor leader. Why? And it's an incredibly important point. Better a bad leader, better a poor leader than no leader altogether. Because if there's no leadership, if there's pandemonium, then ish es re'eu chayim bla'o. Then people can eat each other alive. We fall apart. And I believe the concern with disobeying an order in the summer of 2005 was, would there be, God forbid, civil war? Would the Israeli army, would discipline in the Israeli army disintegrate? I think these were the matters that were at stake, the huge matters that were at stake in this issue, and that even though I believe the soldiers were given an order that was immoral, it was wrong, but nevertheless, I think that the soldiers had to carry it out. And that was in order to preserve the Medina. Because even though the leaders were acting very poorly, if we were to disobey them, it would lead to the disintegration, God forbid, of Medinat Israel. And therefore, I strongly told my student that this is what he did. He obeyed the orders. Thank God he wasn't involved in the direct evacuation of soldiers. He was just protecting the outer ring of the community so it wouldn't be attacked by the Arabs. But sadly, I did tell him to obey orders. So hopefully we shouldn't be in such situations again. Yes, Judah, go ahead.
All right. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you, Judah.
Okay. I was a long time ago at Yad Vashem, and I heard a group of soldiers talking about what it means to obey orders and not to obey orders. And the question is, if it's for a civil war, for something like that, I mean, I'm not comparing it to the Holocaust, but you got a point where everybody's following orders, and then what happens? So at what point do you say that it doesn't make sense?
Okay, that's an important point. Obviously, we Jews are critical of the German soldiers, you know, who would say that they're just following orders. At a certain point, obviously there's got to be a certain point. Where do you draw the line? And that's a very good question. When it comes to maybe as where Yisrael said, maybe when it comes to unjustified murder, that would seem to be that you have to disobey orders. But what if you are ruining people's lives? You're uprooting people. You're making them into miskanim, into unfortunate people. Turning their lives upside down for years. That may be unambiguously wrong, and I'd still say intuitively it's a good question how to quantify, but intuitively I really felt very much thought that Rav Lichtenstein, Rav Aviner, and Rav Avad Yosef were absolutely correct in saying that you've got to obey orders in that kind of a situation. I think civil war would have been worse than the evacuation from Gaza. As bad as the evacuation from Gaza was, I believe civil war would have been worse. Any thoughts?
Yes, a question. In democratic politics, it's not really clear that the prime minister or the president is the absolute leader, as in Melikis, because the Knesset has as much power as he does. So what if you have a situation, the prime minister is doing one thing, and most of the Knesset is really against him, but they're not going to throw him out of office right now. Do you necessarily listen to the prime minister or the Knesset?
That's a good question. In the case of Gaza, the withdrawal from Gaza was supported by an overwhelming majority of the Knesset. The question is, what about Oslo II, which was voted into the Knesset, was approved by the Knesset by a narrow margin, and that majority was obtained by in very questionable manners. But that's a good question. But in the Gaza case, it was approved overwhelmingly by the Knesset, so you didn't have that conflict. Ultimately, if the prime minister is acting against the Knesset, then the prime minister is not acting in accordance with Israeli law. And if the prime minister is in violation of Israeli law, then you wouldn't have to listen to him. But I think that would be the case in 1982 also. The young religious soldier was getting an order that was in violation of Israeli law. So it would seem in that case to be clearly justified to disobey that order. Any thoughts?
Yeah, one other thing. In the case of the tank on Shabbos, it's not clear to me that case is absolutely not Pekuach Nefesh, because tanks are used for Pekuach Nefesh and testing them is for Pekuach Nefesh, and it could be if you don't test it on certain days that gives the enemy some kind of sense of when to attack or some kind of vulnerability.
That's a good question. That's why this young man kept on asking the Mufakeid, his commanding officer, the one that gave him the orders, is there an issue of Pekuach Nefesh here? And the commanding officer said no. He made it unambiguous that there was no issue of Pekuach Nefesh. Go ahead, Rabbi Yisrael. No. Okay, any other thoughts, comments?
We'll let you go.
Let me go? Oh, okay. We'll let everybody go. Everyone, a very good night. And next week, we're going to be speaking about, we're going to keep with the program, Shabbos and technology. Is that correct, Rabbi Kalman?
I have to check the order. I don't recall which week is what. But if you want to do Shabbos and technology, that's fine. I know there's that. I think there's one on the wheels.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you about the wills.
No, I was saying if you want to do next week on technology, fine. We can do that one.
Technology is good. And a Simchas Purim to everyone.
Well,
and thank you. Thank you for those nice thoughts, Rabbi Yisrael and Rabbi Judah. And Rabbi Kalman, again, Yosher Koch, this is great. You're a real pioneer. And hopefully we'll have more and more people joining us. And hopefully we'll have... a lot more, and we'll send Mara McComas once again. Mir Sashem, we need there. We'll get that out for you. And this is a great technology, and I hope we get the opportunity to do this more and more. And hopefully, this will become like a standard way of getting Torah all over to the world, and people Jews all over the world getting together. It's just kavalim.
Yeah, that is one of the goals.
Mashiach will be sure this way, right, Rabbi Kalman?
No, I'm saying that's a goal, but it's not going to happen overnight, that goal. But basically, we need, you know, cover the cover e-play we need. But that's what we're going to build this up.
And, well, Yerushalayim was not built in a day.
All right. Good night, everybody.
Good night, everybody. Good night.